This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So what's this one about, Gary?
Well, today, Pete, we're replaying our podcast entitled V Beach Landing, 25th of April, 1915. That's got the year right.
Why do you like that one, Gary?
Because it's, like, easy to say, V.
Now, Gary, why do you like the drama and what is it that thrills your soul about it?
Well, you've got some real heroes throughout the landings.
Both sides.
Both sides. And, of course, you've got all those machine guns.
Don't, please just don't.
Cheers, Pete.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans about their experience of war. Join me on a journey through the pages of history. Welcome to Peter Hart's Military History.
Hello, and welcome to the Peter Hart Military History Podcast. My name's Peter Hart, and I'm here today with my good friend Gary Bain. And, what are we doing here, Barbara?
Yeah, hi, Pete. What are we going to be talking about today?
Well, I think it's something that's very close to my heart. Let's talk about the landings at V Beach on the 25th of April in 1915 at Gallipoli. I think that's something that floats our boat, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Where should we start?
Well, should we talk about what they're doing and very quickly set the scene? Why are we landing at V Beach, which is on the Hellas Peninsula of Gallipoli? Now, what are they doing there? Well, the answer to this is the start of the Gallipoli campaign. The idea was that Churchill takes a lot of the blame for it, but the whole of the British cabinet is actually responsible. They allow a campaign to begin without any forethought whatsoever, starting with naval operations, with the aim of knocking Turkey out of the war, of getting through the Dardanelles Straits, the straits between Europe and Asia, to get through to Istanbul, or Constantinople as it then was to us, and to knock Turkey out of the war. Easy, you might think, Gary. Easy. I mean, what could go wrong?
Absolutely. So, was the best chance of actually winning a naval campaign?
Yes, probably it was. But they'd already tried that, and on the 18th of March, after a series of bit by bit bombardments, trying to knock out the forts one by one, they made an attempt to force the straits with a large Anglo-French fleet, which the Turks had utterly defeated. Nearly a third of the Anglo-French fleet was put out of action in those operations, and after that, a land campaign was inevitable, and the person put in charge was Ian Hamilton.
Ian Hamilton. So you know, not a name that I'm really familiar with. Was he sort of a second choice general? Why Ian Hamilton?
Well, not really, but partly his age. He was actually, the Germans considered him the most experienced general there was. He'd had a stellar career. He'd nearly won the VC at Majuba Hill back in the 18 Watsits. He nearly won the VC again. Don't ask me what a Majuba Hill was about.
How do you nearly win a VC?
All right. He performed acts of courage for which he was recommended. I think, yes. You put your finger on it. It is a little bit vague. And then he was sort of did something similar in the Boer War. But for one, he was considered too young, and the other one, he was considered too old. Not sure about the legitimacy of all that. But he had done well in the Boer War. He'd been an observer in the Russo-Japanese War. He was an intelligent man. He dabbled in poetry. He was considered an intellectual, which is rare in the British Army, in the sense of, if they are intellectual, they often are at pains to conceal it just because of social pressures. So that's the general in charge. Very experienced, very intelligent, getting on a bit, but not... He hadn't been. He was probably a bit old to be chosen for the British Expeditionary Force in France. He was sort of, you know, he was behind Smith, Dorrien, Haig, and of course Sir John French, who actually led in 1914-15.
So he develops the plan for the landings. What was the Hellespont of his plan?
Well, the Hellespont of the plan is. Is part of the overall thing. Now, one of the problems with Hamilton is he's intelligent. And everybody always says, oh, what an intelligent plan it was. But what they did was he plans to land just about everywhere. So there's two main thrusts. One at Helles, which we'll be dealing with, and the others I'll sketch out quickly. He was going to land at what became known as Anzac, which is halfway up the peninsula, for a direct drive across the peninsula. He had a diversion planned at Belair, another diversion planned by the French further around the coast, another landing by the French on the Asiatic side. He was going to land here, there, and everywhere. I don't know what you think of that kind of, I mean, you know, a plan.
Well, I just find it interesting that you're dispersing your forces. The Turkish would have a large coastal area to defend, and I don't understand why you wouldn't consolidate. I understand having a feint, but not several different landings.
I think that most modern historians, and yes, there is a touch of hindsight that we're operating in, but most modern historians would say, yeah, you're diffusing your strength. Particularly as the Turks were operating a sort of German-inspired tripwire thing. Their commander, Liman von Sanders, had the idea that you wouldn't necessarily try and stop them getting ashore. What you would do would embugger them. You would cause the maximum problem on the beaches. But you weren't really trying to stop them. You were just trying to trip them up, slow them down, and give time for your reinforcements to arrive. And those reinforcements would hurl them back into the sea. In a brutal and bloodthirsty manner. So in a way, you're playing into their hands if you try and land everywhere, because it's easier to stop for the small forces on the coast to stop them. So that's the overall situation. Should we turn to V Beach itself?
Why choose V Beach? Now, you and I have both been to V Beach. Why there?
Because it is a beach, which is quite rare. You know, that some of the other beaches aren't so good. You know, Morto Bay Beach is tempting, but it shoots straight to the back of you from Asia. It's shallow. V Beach is a beach. It's 300 yards long, if not more.
But it's overlooked by a fort. You know, you've got Zed El Bear right on that beach.
It's overlooked by a fort. It's got a castle at the back. It's got, it had by this time, barbed wire. Now, when we talk about barbed wire, we're not talking about Western Front. We're talking about barbed wire fences, almost like a farmer's fence. You know, it's not massed barbed wire. They didn't have much barbed wire. It's defended by a company of men, V Beach. So that was one of the landings. We'll come back to this. And then just along is the other main landing beach, a similar 300-yard beach, W Beach. They're just given letter codes. And then they're ever more complicated. There's also landings going on at S Beach, to the just around the corner from V Beach. That is inside Morto Bay. And then they've got another landing at X Beach, just further up from W Beach. And then another really mad landing at Y Beach. Y Beach, it's nothing but a bloody cliff, as they said. So this is, even within Helles, which in itself is a diffused plan, They're spreading out even at Helles. And each of these landings is not close enough to the other to support each other. So they're all separate landings, you know, in a sense. And they all stand or fail on their own. They can't really support each other.
And while all this is going on, you mentioned the French. And, you know, some people don't actually realise that the French were there. Where were they when we were making these multiple landings?
Well, the French, I'm glad you remind me, they're the landing on the Asiatic side. The British considered it impossible for the time of the landings, for the batteries at Kumkali and behind Kumkali, their Turkish batteries on the Asiatic coast, to be firing into their back on V Beach and the rest, you know, as they advanced up the peninsula. So they insisted that the French land there. This is probably the most dangerous of all the landings at Kumkali in many ways, because the Turks were much closer there. They also had a very small number to face on the beach, but they had large regimental and divisional reserves within close marching distance. So they were there to support us. But it was only for a short time, because the plan is very, very simple. Day one, we'd land. That might cause casualties, but we'd land. The Turks would then give way because they're foreign chappies and couldn't stand up to cold British steel. We would advance. On the first day, we'd take Achibaba, the hill that dominates Hellas. The second day, we would take Khalid Bahir, which is the real dominating range of hills that overlook the narrows of the strait. And on the third day, the fleet would go through. And as people have said, the fourth day, it's, you know, it rains beer, because that's about as likely as any of that plan succeeding.
Now, that description seems to suggest that they...
That's a gravelly tone there. Right?
Yeah, sorry, I'll clear my throat. But it seems to suggest they knew what they were doing, that they had some sort of idea of the land and the topography, and yet there's a suggestion that, you know, the maps weren't very good, they didn't know what they were approaching. Is that true?
Not really. I mean, they had the maps that they had. They had the maps that were made by the French and the British before the French, you know, and topography doesn't change. I mean, were the maps accurate? They were accurate-ish. But the point about this is you can only have the maps that there are. And the Turks, you know, it's not, you can't exactly say to the Turks, oh, we're planning to land here in April. Do you mind if we just send a few scouts ashore to just, you know, map the whole terrain? So you have what you have. The maps fundamentally, there's a great quote from a naval officer who says, you know, they keep saying the maps are no good, but I've looked at the maps and I can see the terrain's laid out clearly before me. He says, actually, most army officers can't read maps. That's the root of the problem. Now, I would hesitate to say that, but accidentally, I've just said it, I think.
Well, I wouldn't, and nothing's changed.
Gasp!
So, they're landing on V Beach. That's one of the main landings.
The two main landings at Helles are V Beach and W Beach, and we're going to concentrate on V Beach.
So what obstacles do they face? You mentioned the barbed wire, but actually the logistics of getting a landing force onto that beach.
Well, let's look at the problem. Basically, and people have pointed out that it's a natural amphitheater. I also point out that most beaches are natural amphitheaters, or they wouldn't be beaches. But, you know, they are surrounded by, you know, it's like a theatre almost. The beach is the stage, and that's what the British are going to land on. To their right, they have the fort of Sedd el Bahr, which is an old 16th century castle. What's left of it. There's a village just above that. At the back of the beach is a fort, a castle, which no longer exists, strangely, but at all. You can't see any trace of it, but it's there in some of the pictures. And then on the left, you've got fort number one, at the top of basically a cliff, and then you've got a line of trenches all the way around. But before we start thinking, oh, this sounds impregnable, there's only one company there. Only one company of the 3rd 26th Regiment. And actually, there's only one battalion, i.e. 1,000 men, Turkish battalion, to defend the whole of Helles. You know, there's a platoon also at S Beach, but let's just leave that out of it. That's from another battalion. But fundamentally, one battalion to defend the whole of Helles against a British division. So 12,000 infantry before you go on to all the supporting arms. So, you know, it's a serious proposition landing on this beach. Let's not, you know, pretend it isn't. But there aren't many men defending it. You know, especially when you think of, you know, you've got your command headquarters, you've got to keep a reserve. So the Turks will have a reserve. And it's quite a big beach, so you spread out, you know, you're, 250 men, remove the... You've got about 200 men firing on the beach, so it's quite interesting.
And how did they decide they were going to overcome that sort of obstacle? Where did the plan develop to get the men to the beach?
Well, the first plan is to land the battalion 1st Dublin Fusiliers, fine body of men, and soon to become fine bodies of men, as the old joke goes. And that's literally true in this case. That they were to land from strings of rowing boats. They'd be towed in by a little motorboat, then cast off, and then they'd be rowed in by Jolly Jack tars. One of the things is, of course, no soldier can row, certainly not at that time, and probably not now. And they would row into shore and land.
Sorry, can I just ask, we've been to the Dardanelles, the current is, shall we say, somewhat challenging. Rowing what sort of distance in that current?
Basically about 100, 200 yards, just the last 100, 200 yards into shore. But people, you know, that's the plan. And they're going to land on the beach, and then another a company going to land round the corner. Well, let's forget them, because they just get slaughtered eventually. But mainly they're going to land on the beach, you know. And this is where it's quite interesting, because there's a couple of British officers who are real, to me, heroes. And one of them is Commander Edward Unwin. Now, he was commanding almost a yacht. Well, it was a yacht. It was a communications yacht, HMS Hussar. He'd retired before the war. He was quite an elderly gentleman. He was 51, gosh.
Wow, you know, very old.
Very old, yeah. And now Unwin hears about these plans, and he says, hang on a minute, they're going to land on this beach, you know. They're going to get shot to bits, you know. And he comes up with the idea of the River Clyde. And his idea is brilliant, in my view. Brilliant idea doesn't mean it's brilliant in practice. And the idea is that you have a converted old merchantman, the River Clyde. You convert it to take troops. You cut holes in the side and put gangplanks along the side. And they meet at the front. And then you have barges to come and provide a sort of bridge from the front gangway of this adapted merchantman to the shore. And that's his idea. And then you have 2,000 or 3,000 men on board, the 2,500 it is, aboard the Clyde, and they'll open their doors, rush down the gangways, onto the front, onto the barges, and ashore. And this allows them to have a mass of troops getting ashore quickly. They can have 10 or 12 machine guns. It's never 11 in any of the accounts. It's always 10 or 12 machine guns to provide a mass of machine gun fire to swamp Turkish defences. And you can just have all your stores and everything on board. It's almost like a modern landing, you know, like HMS Fearless in the Falklands or in the Intrepid. It's a sort of early version of that. And that was Unwin's plan. And as it was his plan, he was given command of it.
I've heard it described as a Trojan horse.
Husky.
Excuse me.
Well, yes, Trojan horse. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Because all these officers, public school boys, that's unfair. A lot of them are, aren't they? And they have these, they've all studied the Iliad or whatever it is, you know. And
You had Rupert Brooke and the Romance of Troy and all of that.
Yeah, Rupert hadn't quite made it there.
Unfortunately.
He'd sadly died from an insect bite, which is very romantic. And septicemia, which is less romantic. They have this idea. And you make a joke of it. The idea of the Trojan horse is a bunch of Greeks, you know, leave this large horse with a load of Greeks hidden inside it, and they leave it on the beach and then sail off, and the Trojans drag it into Troy and then have a huge piss up to, you know, celebrate winning the Trojan War. Hey, we won the Trojan War, you know. And then when they're all pissed out of their skulls and unconscious and the rest of it, they burst out of the wooden horse of Troy and kill everybody. Well, the thing is, you know, when the River Clyde runs ashore, you think the Turks think, oh, look, a big prezi, let's take it to Constantinople. What can you? Ooh, hooray, we've won. Or do they, cold-heartedly and with, you know, narrowed eyes, you know, cartoon villains, just aim their rifles at those doors that have been cut in the side? Do they pick a point to aim at and then just blast them? And that's what hadn't been thought through, because you're creating a natural defile, you know, because they don't have to aim at individual men. They just aim at one point, the door or the front of the, you know. And that's not the only thing that goes wrong.
Yeah, so I think some of the rowing boats were meant to be towed. I don't think that went particularly smoothly. And I believe that Commander Unwin took control of the situation.
Well, yeah, the boats, the tows, you know, that were the rowing, the people being rowed ashore, as they get near shore, it's as Unwin predicts, a massive fire bursts out, and those people are slaughtered. They're really shot to bits. The boats are shot to bits. In particular, when the sailors, the Jolly Jack Tars who are rowing, are killed, of course the boats start to go around in circles because, as I said, soldiers can't row boats. So they have a terrible trouble getting ashore. They're shot to bits, and the remnants gather beneath a sandbank just about 3 or 4 foot high. And there's a famous photo, which I'm sure Matt will put on the website. You've been there.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've actually... The bank is still there in some form, and you can crouch down behind it. I'm aware of the photograph. The photograph's from the bridge of the River Clyde. And it's over one of the boats, and you at first think that there are soldiers in the boat waiting to be landed, but to the left they're alive, to the right they're dead, and then you can see, I think it's the Dublin Fusiliers, crouched behind this tiny bank in broad daylight, I hasten to add, and it just demonstrates the lunacy, if you like, of trying to get men across open water onto a beach, which, was a lesson learnt for the Second War.
It was. And, what happens is a farce, because Unwin has thought ahead and got barges ready, and there's a barge, and a rowing boat and all that, and they have a little steam tug to pull it, and there's a little steam tug, and it's meant to pull the barges to the front of the Clyde. Fabulous. Thought of everything. So who should we put in the tug? I'll tell you what. Why don't we put one sailor, one 15, 16-year-old midshipman, and a bunch of Greeks. Now, with the best will of the world, the Greeks aren't in this war. They're neutral. And when everybody opens fire, what do you think they do? Well, they batten the hatches down, go below deck, and refuse to come out. And who can blame them? What happens to the thing? It goes off to the left. You can just see the back of it in the picture. That means that there's no way ashore properly from the gangways to the thing. And, the Clyde, people think it ran ashore, but actually it had had kerfuffles coming in. It was quite a way out. It's 80 to 100 yards offshore. The water's 5 or 6 foot deep, probably more. So how'd you get ashore?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And so Unwin's observing this. It's his plan. So he must have had some sense of ownership of this. And he takes action, I think, with an able seaman. What does he do?
Well, I've got nothing but admiration. It's his plan. He's been put in charge of it. But he's an officer who takes responsibility when things go wrong. His plan has failed. He hadn't thought it through. That no one had thought it through. They hadn't got a bridge ashore, a way of getting ashore. So he, with an excellently named sailor called William Williams, I think it was, who's taken a demotion to go with his... from the Hussar to join him on this thing. They go, they just jump into the water, they tie a rope from the barges around them, and they form a human anchor on the rocks. And all this under, you know, and they actually create a bridge to get ashore for the men on the ship. It is quite amazing what's happening here. I mean, it's a real... One man making a difference. The army love to talk about this. You can make a difference. You can personally make a difference if you really try. And that enabled the Royal Munster Fusiliers to make the first assault from either side of the River Clyde.
And I believe that Unwin was dressed in his whites.
No, that's later. That's later. That's when he goes back on board and changes to go and rescue people. Yeah, that. But yes, later on he is. That's right. And the famous picture of him is in his white. The famous model of picture of the model. Now the Dublins were meant to come out. It runs ashore. What, 6:22? I can't remember. It runs ashore anyway at some time or other. They were in Lawley, yeah, 6:22, and they go ashore. And there's an account. I'll just read you one account there's two. One from the boat. This is from Sergeant Colgan of the Dublin Fusiliers. He's in the boat. This shows the two ways of getting ashore. And this one: there were 32 in my boat, and only 6 escaped alive, including O'Hanlon, who had his hand blown off. One fellow's brains were shot into my mouth as I was shouting to them to jump for it. I dived into the sea. You know, that's what's happening in the boat. It's awful. Well, that quote makes me feel almost sick. It's just horrible. And then on the boat itself was what is his name? Guy Geddes. Of course it's Guy Geddes. And here's a quote from him. And I wonder if you, when I read this, whether you notice anything about the tone of it. This is Guy Geddes, and he's going down the left-hand gangplank out of the Clyde onto the bridge provided by Unwin. He says this: "We got it like anything. Man after man behind me was shot down, but they never wavered. Lieutenant Watts was wounded in 5 places and landing on the gangplank, cheering the men on with cries of, 'Follow the captain!' I think no finer episode could be found of the men's bravery and discipline than this, of leaving the safety of the River Clyde to go to what was practically certain death. I dashed down their gangway and already found the lighters holding the dead and wounded from the leading platoons." And what do you notice about that?
Well, it's all about him. So following him, the bravery of the squaddies, following the noble officer from the boat.
And I think that's it. And it's that. I don't mean... I have the highest regard for Guy Geddes. He's a great officer. But it's interesting that the different ways of saying how great you are is by saying how brave the men who follow you are. And that's a thing you get from 1914-1915 accounts. It does back off after that. He was an extremely brave officer. They're shot to bits. Some of them get ashore. They join the rest of the Munster Fusiliers, the Dublin Fusiliers under the sandbank, and they try and move right up to the castle where Geddes is wounded in the shoulder. Now, one thing, who's shooting at them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to, if I may, introduce a little controversy here. They are receiving enfilade fire from machine guns, aren't they?
Well, this is the popular viewpoint, and it's become a real controversy, because by our accounts, there's 4, 5, 6 umpteen Turkish machine guns resisting the landings, the W Beach and V Beach landings. However, the Turkish, you know, and I don't think that this is tenable, despite what I previously thought.
Yeah, I think in the defeat at Gallipoli, I think you reference the machine guns, Pete, actually.
I do. But one of the things about history is you look at the evidence, you see how it takes you. And I did write that because I was convinced by all the British accounts which referred to machine guns. And so, being a young, naive historian of only about 40 at the time, I put that. Since then, I've been taken aside by various Turkish historians under the guidance of Ken Ancelik and Bill Sellers, two very well known historians who live out, well, one's Turkish and one's Australian, but they guided me through the Turkish sources. I don't read Turkish. The thing is, it's quite clear that there were no machine guns there. They didn't have any in the order of battle. Now, people refer to a variety of reasons they could be there. You know, the Turks just didn't write it down. It's as if they were some sort of primitive organisation. They were as big a bureaucracy as the British for running their empire, you know. That they'd been landed from naval boats. Well, we know when they came ashore from naval boats. They came ashore on the 5th, 6th of May. The thing is, you know, I always say, you know what you have on your side, but it's difficult to know what's shooting at you because you're being shot at. Now, what was shooting at them was up to 200 men firing rifles at them, plus there was some Nordenfeldt sort of automatic hand-wound machine guns. Now, I think that might explain what the problem is, because they chew boats to bits, these things. They're Nordenfeldt, 1-inch, there's one outside the Tower of London. Not outside, inside, but outside the Royal Fusiliers Museum. I think they got that from X-Speech.
So how do you explain all the accounts? There's lots of accounts, there's lots of quotes from, you know, people that were there.
It's just you're under a lot of fire. And if you're under fire, I mean, they're under a storm of fire, you know. But the point is, the Turkish records are quite clear. And they're also clear about when machine guns arrive and the rest of it. And it's like an answer. It's clear from the Turkish records. Why would they lie? It's not that our chaps are lying, because they're not, but they are mistaken, in my belief. But we might be wrong.
But, you know, there are references to hearing it. Soldiers generally can tell the difference, and there are references to hearing machine gun fire.
And they can hear a machine gun fire, because the Vickers is just a Maxim with the lock upside down. And they can hear the massed machine gun fire. In fact, I doubt if they could hear anything else but the British massed machine gun fire. And this creates a confusion. Now, people say, will you bet your house that there was no Turkish machine guns there? Well, firstly, the Nordenfeldt, in my view, is a type of machine gun. So, you know. And secondly, no, I won't. I've changed my mind once. If people bring forward the evidence, I'll change my mind again. But at the moment, guided by people whose judgment I respect, I believe there were no machine guns on V Beach.
Although I believe they were just later in the day.
Possibly. I don't think so then either now. And that's another thing I keep changing my mind on, whether they brought some up later. I don't think they did. I think the machine guns are further back. And, you know, it's a moot point. Shall we leave it to that? Possibly. There's a thread on something called the Great War Forum that's got 8,472,000,000,000 posts on this, mostly with two or three people going through the same argument again and again and again. I'd prefer to think that the men were under heavy fire, which I personally, I'm a coward, which anybody, any brave soldier would have hated being under, and it was awful. They were shot to bits.
Okay, so they're affecting the landings. What about the other beaches?
Well, they go, I mean, W Beach do quite well, but they try and get across to V Beach, but they can't because the Turks have a fort on the intervening hill. That fort is basically where, not a defended position, is where the Hellas Memorial is, on that hill there, on the crest of that hill. And as you know, that dominates the ground between the two. They get no further. S Beach, they land, they get ashore, there's only a platoon of Turks there. They've got more troops ashore at S Beach than there are Turks in the whole of Hellas. But they've been ordered to stay there, and they make the decision that if they abandon that ridge, which they're part of the ridge, then the Turks, they thought there was a division there. So they make the decision to hold the position, wait for the British to come forward. Are they wrong or right? I don't know. I think they're probably right to obey orders. X Beach, they land, and this is the problem of having a beach that isn't a proper beach. It's really, you know, there's only there's 12 Turks there, so they get ashore almost unscathed. But then there's a complete mess up, and a small Turkish account, apparently by thousands, but in actual fact by at most a platoon or at most a company, you know, flings them back and they don't really achieve anything. Y Beach, which is meant to be the jab in the ribs of the Turkish defenders, they land. It's it's a cliff. They get to the top. They're probably knackered. They don't dig in properly, and they are the first that the Turkish counterattacks hit that night, and they have to evacuate next morning. So V Beach is a failure amidst a collection of partial successes or failures.
So it's getting no support from the other beaches. In fact, they're probably too far away anyway. And we return to the debacle of getting ashore. Now, Unwin and William Williams, I think, struggle for around about an hour.
I don't think people know. I'd say you're about right. I don't know. And then William Williams is mortally wounded, as they say. And Unwin comes back aboard ship, you know, absolutely knackered. There's then a farcical pier where a bunch of midshipmen take over. I don't know their first names at the moment. Drury, Morse and Mallison are the three. And they're basically trying to tie these lighters ashore. And there's a great account from one of them of how they sort of swim from one to the other, and they say, "Have you got the rope?" "No, they've left the rope." And that's almost like a Carry On film, you know, you just have to, anyway. But I mean, to carry it whilst people are dying, so it's, you know, and the landing is suspended, because although they manage to get things together, every time they try to land, the Turks open up on them. They have fire discipline. They're being fired at by the 10-12 machine guns on the Clyde, so they're keeping their heads down unless something's happening. So they only fire when something's happening, and that's what's going on for the next bit. They have another major attempt when Brigadier Napier arrives. Brigadier Napier sort of comes past in the second wave it's meant to be, and he says, "Why aren't these men landing? What's going on?" And somebody shouts from the Clyde, "Oh, you'll be buggered if you try and land here." So, "Well, I'll have a damn good try." Him and he go around the corner, shot, killed. Bodies never recovered. His brigade major, his chief, his staff officers killed. I mean, they can't get anywhere. I mean, you know, they're meant to be at the end of the day on Achibaba. Then they've captured from the sea to the sandbank, which is about, 12 yards at most. You know, that's all they get.
Can we talk about some of the personalities? I'd like to introduce the way the British officers were behaving. So I think there's a quote about a very famous individual, Doughty Wiley, and I'll describe it as Willy waving.
Yes, this is the biggest problem. Him and Carrington Smith, who commanded the Hampshire, Wiley, Doughty Wiley, no, Charles Doughty Wiley, but known to his friends as Dick for some reason. down, Carruthers. And Carrington, and they would not take proper cover. It's really, it's a British Army thing that you don't, damn foreigners shooting at us, and it's sort of, it's the old Australian idea of you adjust your monocle and carry on, and it's stupid. And it is stupid. And they do it time and time again. Unwin is watching. I mean, he's brave, but he only exposes himself, so to speak, when there's danger. As he says about Doughty Wiley, "I could not keep Doughty Wiley from unnecessarily exposing himself over the iron screen, so I gave up at last." And the modern mind has got another version of that, which we won't dwell on. But the point is, that's what they did. They stood there, tall and erect. And that... No need for that expression. Well, thank God we're not on video. So they're doing that. And actually, Carrington Smith goes, and Colonel Herbert Carrington Smith, he goes up and refuses to take cover, and he's killed. And that leaves, funny enough, that leaves Doughty Wiley pretty well in command, because the other officer, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Tizard, he's commanding the Munsters, is not like this. He takes cover, he's sensible, he does his job. But later on, he gets into trouble because he's not behaving like a bloody idiot. And this is quite, he actually gets sacked next day because he is an idiot. He is sensible. He doesn't expose himself unnecessarily. So the landings have failed. And at this point, you mentioned the white suit.
Yes.
This is another bit of a man who wants to make the difference. And Edward Unwin, he's gone. He's got changed. Now, what can he get changed into? Well, all he can find is his yachting suit, which is white. And he can hear the men wounded are lying about in the water, a lot of them. And and they're drowning, they're dying, and he can't stand it. This is his plan, remember, as far as he's concerned. He is a man who takes responsibility. And he gets into the water, and with a couple of others, volunteers, and he takes a boat and takes it to the wounded, pulls them into the boat, and then takes the boat back to the Clyde. Are the Turks opening fire at him? Yes, but not particularly, if you see what I mean. In other words, this isn't a danger to them. They've got fire discipline. So that, you know, but he is in incredible danger. It's extremely brave of him. And I love one particular quote from him, which is basically that... you know, he gets absolutely exhausted and goes back on. And a young officer says, "What are you doing? Go back on." He said, "I couldn't do any more. After all, I was 51, you know." and he just think, but he was what a hero Unwin was, and all of these guys are real heroes. But that's really the story, you know, of the 25th of April. That's how far we got. That's as much as we do.
So, British failure or Turkish success?
Oh, well, I cannot fault the heroism of those guys landing, you know. But do they succeed? Well, the answer is no. I mean, they don't succeed in any of their objectives, do they?
No.
All they do is demonstrate incredible courage. And there are, I think, 6 VCs awarded that day. And well merited, in my view. But do they get any? Do they do anything? Do they achieve anything? No. Now, why is that? Is it the incredible strength of defences, or is it the defences and the Turks? And in my view, at the centre of this story is the 3rd 26th Battalion of the Turk. You know, the 3rd Battalion of the 26th Regiment of the Turks. What a bunch of heroes. Colonel Mahmut, I think it is, commanding that. They just do unbelievably well. They may panic at times. There's a letter that's quite amusing. My captain, the enemy's infantry is taking cover at the back of Sedal Bar. What shall I do? You know, if I had more men, I'd charge them and throw them back into the sea, which is a touch of steel, which you expect from a Turkish. But, you know, my captain, for God's sake, send reinforcement. Hurry up. What on earth will happen, my captain? It's a fantastic quote, you know. But there's no panic in the sense of they carry on doing their duty. They fight to the end. Most of them are killed, you know. And it's only next day that the story moves on. One point I'd like to make about this machine gun business. When night falls, they get the men ashore. They get the men ashore because... how come? Machine guns can fire on fixed lines. You know that?
Yeah.
With you, it's a GPMG, but any Vickers, any Maxim can fire on a fixed line. So what's to stop a machine gun just firing on the beach from, you know, where they can hear things happening, just opening fire? Well, rifle fire you can't, because rifle you have to aim it. So you guess you can have a fixed rifle, but not to stop a load of people coming ashore. So that's another interesting point. They get ashore. There's a quote from a midshipman, I've remembered his name, George Drury, and he says, you know, they're just going ashore. They're treading on the wounded. They're treading on the dead. They don't know where they're wounded. And he said, some of the poor devils are in an awful state, and a bit that I think really hits home. I never knew that blood smelt so strong before. And you just go, wow, this is awful. There's this story that the seas were red with blood. I don't know whether the seas were red with blood or not. There is a red form of seaweed that from the air may have looked like it, and I've seen it like that. But there were certainly an awful lot of people killed on that boat, that beach that day. Don't ask me for figures, because I don't think they ever really knew, because there were so many casualties over the next day. But it was a scene of slaughter and of sacrifice. So what are they going to do now?
So do they capture the fort?
Well, not till next day, not till 8 o'clock next day. And by then, Doughty Wiley is taking a real role. You know, he's gone ashore, and Tizard doesn't go ashore. This is the point, but Doughty Wiley goes ashore, and he leads. And he's got a cane. And people like to say that he only had a cane because he'd served with the Turks, you know, in the pre-war years, and he didn't want to kill a Turk. I think he knew he couldn't hit a barn door with a Webley. He wasn't going to carry a rifle. And therefore, A cane makes, and this is the battlefield joke of battlefield guides, a cane makes it easier to point at what you want because it extends your arm and makes it obvious. I think that's why he was carrying a cane. But he shows a heroism. But what is great about Doughty Wiley at this point is you can make jokes about him all you like, you can be cruel about him, and you know. But what he does is organise. He is a senior staff officer, and he organises. He gets naval support for bombardment on the village, you know, and the fort at the top, the castle at the top. He organises the Dublins, the remnants of the Dublins, and the Munsters and the Hampshires. They're the other battalion on the ship, and he organises it all, and then he leads it. Should he lead it? Well, one of the other officers says that the men were sticky, you know. Mm. And by sticky, what he means is that it's not that they're running away. It's just that they really need leadership.
They need motivating.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're going to not do anything. And seeing a colonel out front risking his life is good for the men, you know, if you like. So they charge. They take the fort, the Sedobar fort, and then they charge through the village. He gets a bullet knocks his cap off. You know, it's that much. He's under fire. He's brave, and then they sort of advance up the village.
This is Krithia.
No, Sedobar village, immediately behind it. Sorry, I didn't make that clear. And this is where one of my favourite stories comes. Perhaps you know, I know that you like small animals, don't you?
Yeah, I believe there were some local cats, I believe, that were particularly friendly.
Yeah, I've got a car. I can't read. This is Lieutenant George Davidson of the 89th Field Ambulance. He's coming along behind the front, and he sees a cat in the middle, and he says, "I was very sorry for a cat that had cuddled close to the face of a dead Turk in the street, one leg embracing the top of his head. I went up to stroke and sympathise with it for the loss of what I took to be its master, when I found that the upper part of the man's head had been blown away, and the cat was enjoying a meal of human brains."
And I'm sure he said it in exactly that way.
Zombies. They didn't have zombies then, did they? That's a modern thing, isn't it? But so they go through, and they get to the top of the hill, and they're coming up to what's known as the castle. It's this low-lying fort thing at the top. And there's very few Turks left by this time. I mean, some of the British officers... Now, I'm catching your croaky throat there. Some of the British officers make it quite clear that there's not many people up there by this time. But Doughty Wiley leads the men up. He leads the assault, and they take it. And they have taken V Beach, and it's done by about 1 o'clock, I think, that day. Yeah, 13:30. So up that top by 2 o'clock, and they're there. And then tragedy strikes.
Tragedy?
Well, Doughty Wiley is killed in his moment of triumph. But how is he killed, Gary? How do you think?
Well. Based on his characteristics, I would think he'd be busy exposing himself.
And I'm afraid that's the case. Private William Flynn of the Munsters, 1st Munsters, said, "He stood up alongside of me with his officer, with his orderly, sorry. They were shouting to him, 'Get down, sir, you'll get hit,' because there was sniping. He wouldn't, and an explosive bullet hit him just below the eye, blowing all the side of his face out, and his orderly got killed." Now, the thing about this is there's 2 points about this. One is the poor old orderly. If your officer's standing up, you have to stand up. And even today, I heard a great story about a Northern Ireland officer, Jack Sheldon, who had to stand up when the general came round. I know the general as well, but I'm not going to give his name. And you have to, even with the IRA was shooting at him, but he still had to stand there because the general was stood there. And it hasn't changed. But the thing about it was that there was no need for it. He was warned. And it's this... standing there, willy-waving, we call it. And it's foolishness itself. It's something that the British Army doesn't eradicate in 15 properly. It's something the Australian forces suffer from as well. We talked about Monash the other day. Monash didn't do this, but lots of British officers serving the Australians, lots of Australian officers did do it. But he was killed, and he dies, and he's buried there. We've been to his grave, haven't we? It's, you know, it's one of the very few single graves.
It is, and I'd like to touch on, I'm not sure if this is rumour, if this is fact, if there's any evidence, but there is a suggestion that either his wife Lillian or his mistress, who I think was
Gertrude Bell,
Gertrude Bell visited the grave on the 17th of November 1915.
It's an interesting topic. We heard an excellent presentation on this at the Gallipoli Association conference. And my answer is it was almost certainly his wife, because documentary evidence would stand against the other one. I don't know. I'll be absolutely honest, I don't actually care either. You know, it's not, to me, it's one of those sidelights that sometimes historians obsess about, which is good fun. Which is why you raised it, obviously. But I don't know. I think it was his wife, if anybody, who was a very patient woman, I believe, as of course is Mrs. Bain.
Yes, absolutely. And just to close, if I may, it's a slight aside. What happened to the River Clyde?
Well, the River Clyde, well, it stays there. It stays there on the beach. And there it stayed for the rest of the campaign under occasional shell fire from across the straits. And then it went. They pulled it off, and it went off to be a tramp steamer. Again, just what it was. And there's one great account during a 1936 visit. You know, all the old veterans are on a ship going off, and bloody River Clyde passes them. Well, not passes, I think it's going the other way. But they see it. And in about early 1960s, it was getting old, and they were going to scrap it, and they offered it to the British government. You know, but they wanted a sum of money, you know, 12 and sixpence or something.
So the British government immediately stumped up.
Yes, no. British government said, you can... And that was the end of it. And they scrapped it because the Spanish were true to their word, or Portuguese, whoever had it by then. So that was the end of that. What happens in the rest of the campaign? Does next day they capture Achibaba? No, they never get past anywhere. V Beach is an utter failure. It is a really, really bad failure. I think, again, go back to it. They hadn't thought it through, had they? It was a great idea of Unwin's, and he performed brilliantly. But he hadn't thought it through. No one had thought it through. They created defiles, a position where you can just shoot at. You don't have to aim at an individual, just shoot. By the way, rowing boats are the same, of course. You don't aim at, but you just aim at the rowing boat. And they've created the same situation at the front, down the sides and the front of the thing. There wasn't enough strength. It was ridiculous. The way they landed. Where should they have landed? I think probably somewhere between the Comatell, you know, in the centre of to the south of Anzac, south of Gaba Tepe, between that beach around about the Comatell, right the way through to Suvla. Should have landed the whole bloody force there, possibly with a feint or two, and then gone straight across, taken the Anzac Hills and made a real thrust for Kilidbahir, which, by the way, was the plan that they'd been thinking of earlier on in 1906 or whenever they last looked at it. You know, V Beach, heroism on both sides, but in the end, one battalion of Turks held back, you know, the 12,000 men of the 29th Division who tried to land that day at Hellas. It was their triumph.
Well, thank you very much, Pete, and I can't wait until we talk some more.
Cheers. Thanks, Gary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?